welcome to She Runs the World, episode 3. Today we're going to be talking to Kate McNamara on international politics, and especially Europe and the U.S. So I'm Kai.
I'm Emily.
And to give you a bit of a background on Professor McNamara, she is a professor of government and foreign service at Georgetown University. Her work focuses on the evolution of political authority in the European Union, the politics of the euro and the European Central Bank, and international political economy issues more generally. Her recent work explores the populism in the EU and the interaction between economic circumstances and identity in the US. At Georgetown, Dr. McNamara served as director of the Mortera Center for International Studies from 2010 to 2016, building a robust scholarly infrastructure for faculty, a new undergraduate research fellows program, and promoting vibrant interdisciplinary debate over key global challenges. She also has taught at Princeton University and Sciences Po Paris, and has been a visiting scholar at the Russell Sage Foundation, a German Marshall Fund Fellow, and a Fulbright Fellow. McNamara received her PhD from Columbia University and her BA from McGill University. Welcome.
Thank you. I'm really happy to be here.
Let's start off by just telling us a little bit about yourself. How did you get interested in international politics, political economy, all that?
Great. Well, I was interested in international politics, I think, in a very deep sense, because I was actually the daughter of a diplomat. So I was born in El Salvador, and then we lived in the Philippines, and then Washington, D.C., and then I went to high school in Geneva, Switzerland, and my dad was a trade negotiator. But of course, as a teenager, I thought that was all deadly boring and incredibly, you know, dull and so on. But I realize now that my exposure to all those different places and to thinking about how people live and live together and sometimes, you know, come into conflict with each other really probably is rooted a little bit in just my experience growing up. But interestingly, I actually did not major in political science as an undergrad. I was a geography major, and I was really interested in urban geography and studying kind of how things unfold over place and space. And it wasn't until very much later that I actually figured out that I wanted to do a PhD in political science.
So having been all over the world, what made you study Europe in particular?
Well, that way I got to do research in London and Brussels and Paris, and that seemed like a really good idea. You know, I have a colleague in grad school who was studying China before it sort of liberalized and opened up, and he would describe sitting in these archives and libraries with like no heat and the lights would go on and off and so on. And meanwhile, I'd be enjoying myself, you know, in the capitals of Europe. But more to the point, I really was trained in international relations at a time when Europe was kind of coming together in a lot of different and really interesting ways. And they were talking about moving to a single currency for the European Union, which ultimately became the euro. And I thought that was the most bizarre and crazy idea, right? Because currencies historically have always had a one-to-one relationship with nation states, right? We have an American dollar, a Canadian dollar, Mexican peso, whatever. And so for somebody trained in international relations, the thought that states would voluntarily give up sovereignty over their money struck me as very weird, and I wanted to try to figure it out. So that's how I ended up writing a dissertation on Europe. It wasn't just because I wanted to travel in Europe, actually. There was an intellectual reason why.
Yeah. Well, so kind of like the motivations that were going on then, do you think, like, how does that parallel to what's going on now where people are taking like, kind of the opposite reaction, backing away from the euro?
Right. Well, it's interesting. I mean, as a political scientist, I always emphasized how, you know, how precarious and strange and in a way kind of deeply fraught politically the euro was. So in a way, I wasn't super surprised when the eurozone crisis happened and now we see a backlash against the euro. Because, you know, folks trained in politics, I think, would understand that, you know, these are really contested and important things. But the euro was framed when it came about as this sort of technocratic exercise that it was just a solution to a big open single market in Europe, so clearly they need a single currency. And it was really kind of sold in a way to make people kind of underplay how actually it was an assault on sovereignty, right? So everything went great until the 2008 financial crisis. And then, you know, all the kind of go-go years of the early euro Everyone sort of had to pay up all their bills. And that's when you really started to see people realizing, wait a minute, this is a really important thing that affects people on a day-to-day level. So in the end, and I actually did write in several places that the euro was bound to be something that would be very politically contested. So I wrote that early on, I'm happy to say.
Do you think it's going to survive?
Yes, I think it will survive, actually. I think one of the things that is so surprising is how European elites have sort of doubled down on it. You know, so the European Central Bank, which is the single independent central bank for the Eurozone, has spent, you know, a billion euros defending it, right? I mean, they've sort of done all kinds of different, what are sort of uncommon monetary policies, things like buying up the bonds of the different nation states that are priced in euros but are actually their national debt and so on, to try to stabilize things. So I think those sort of heroic efforts have stabilized things and really indicate continued political commitment.
So you're talking about like the fear for like loss of sovereignty. Yeah. Like, to what extent have you seen that? Do you think any of that's coming back now that people want renegotiation?
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because, you know, the country that of course feels this the most acutely is the UK, right? Which has never been a member of the Eurozone. They did sort of exchange rate cooperation before the Euro, but they've never been part of the Euro. They still have British pounds with the Queen on them and everything like that, right? Mm-hmm. And Britain has always had this very love-hate relationship with the rest of Europe, right? Where they have benefited tremendously from a big open single European market. They've benefited tremendously from the free movement of labor so that, you know, the City of London can take all the best and brightest from the rest of Europe to work in all the banks and so on. And, you know, Romanian nannies can come over and take care of people's kids in London who are working in those big banks and so on. But at the same time, you know, the Brits have this sort of history of being a great power, and I think for them sovereignty is something that they still hold very closely. And so the backlash against the Europe in general has been, you know, sort of harshest in Britain, but we still, of course, have seen the Euro crisis have all kinds of different types of backlashes as well. So the southern countries like Greece that had to suffer great austerity programs because they, you know, had borrowed a lot and couldn't pay back their bills, they obviously have pushed back. But interestingly, they still view the euro as better than going back to the Greek currency because it's much more stable. They can borrow on international markets and so on and so forth. So I think that even though it's an incredibly imperfect system, it will continue.
So looking at your bio, it seems like like your interest like kind of transitioned from like strictly political economy mm-hmm. to kind of looking at this idea of what it means to be European and how that like plays into the economy in reverse. So how do you think in the U.S. maybe how like identity politics mm-hmm. and economic politics mm-hmm. kind of interact?
Mm-hmm. That's a great question, and you're exactly right. So my early work was very much focused on, you know, this puzzle that I had, and I will say, you know, for my Georgetown undergrads, I always emphasize that the best research papers are the papers where you just want to figure something out, right? You need to be passionate to kind of, you know, do all the hard work to try to figure out the answer to your question. And that's how I felt about my dissertation. And I came up with this argument about the euro as sort of this thing that solved some of the problems states were facing around high inflation and things like that. And so they felt like, yes, we're giving up a lot, but given the situation in the world with capital mobility and so on and so forth, this is sort of the best we can do. And they shared a bunch of ideas about that. So my later work, actually, I realized that it really was interesting to think about the fact that the EU is the only example we have historically of a currency zone that has persisted even without it being part of a broader kind of state-building project. So like in the United States, people don't realize this, but we had a bunch of different currencies circulating until the Civil War, and that's when we got the greenback, right, where they kind of outlined, oh, you guys know that, that's impressive. You've obviously been very well trained here at Georgetown. But you see this again and again, that it's sort of the second half of the 19th century when states kind of consolidate their power over currency, that it's part of these broader political projects. So if that's the case, and we know those political projects really only work if you can also create a sense of national identity, right, to kind of underpin things like a single currency or an army or, you know, taxation or, you know, all the types of things that governments, where they want to accrue power, that you need to have a sense of common identity and sort of shared purpose, shared sort of social identity. So that leads to the question of, well, they have a currency, but do they have a shared single identity, right? So my second book, which is called The Politics of Everyday Europe, went a different direction and really looked more broadly at the EU as an example of what I call political development, sort of a new emergent political form. And the punchline answer is, well, there is a common European identity, but it's not a single identity, right? So people still feel Spanish and European or Belgian and European. But it's a very thin identity. It's not like the impassioned identity that you have for, you know, a sovereign nation state, say the American, you know, identity where we go to a football game and everyone sings the national anthem and it's rah, rah, rah. Instead, the European identity, I argue, is a much more kind of in the background, banal, kind of, I talk about everyday practices, crossing borders without a passport, sharing, they all have these burgundy passports in the European Union with the European Union on them, but then also their national symbol. So things like that, where people get used to kind of reframing themselves as part of this broader European identity, but it's not this sort of impassioned one where they would like go to war to defend it. And that creates problems politically, because when things get tough, you don't have the same kind of love of nation to call upon. So that's what that book looked at.
Yeah, because like every nation in Europe has a very different, like, unique history relative to all the others. And like, I feel like it's easy in the U.S. to, you know, view Europe as like a collective, because it's like all of it is all the way across the ocean. Like, we have people in the United States from all over the world, and we, like, a lot, like, I know, like, I'm from like half the countries in Europe, my family. So it's like really easy to kind of like blend that, but. You know, that's a very detached perspective from what it is on the ground.
Right.
With all the...
Well, it's interesting. So there's the work on identity shows that our identities are not like a fixed thing. Instead, they get activated in different situations. So maybe here, you know, in the United States, you might feel kind of more like, you know, a Texan or something, whereas a Texan going to Europe feels more like an American, right? Just as a German, perhaps, in Europe might feel more German, but then they come here and they feel European. So we sort of... you know, contextualize our identity based on the situation. And I write a lot about that. And I sometimes will use kind of personal examples of, you know, so I'm a scholar, I'm a teacher, but I'm also a mother and I'm a daughter and, you know, I'm an Episcopalian and I'm a yogi, you know, so I've got all these different identities and in different interactions, social interactions in different places, one will come to the fore, right, over the other. And everyone's unique, right? We all are kind of an assemblage of those different identities. Like, we have our own little fingerprint of who we are. And so I get kind of annoyed when people talk, you know, scholars talk about identity as something that's sort of fixed and unchanging. We have to have a kind of more dynamic understanding of it, which is hard to study, but I think that's the right way forward.
Yeah, like, coming to Georgetown, like, I felt, like, a lot of, like, state pride and being from Michigan, just because, like, everyone was all over, from everywhere else. And But, like, back in Michigan, you never really... feel that, because everyone else is also from Michigan, you know?
That's a great example.
But I actually read your Politics of Everyday Europe book for my comparative political systems class, and it just seems like kind of what the EU is trying to do, like building a sense of national loyalty to Europe in general while not like infringing on like French identity or German identity. It seems like a very precarious balance.
I agree.
And like something can just tip it off and everything kind
of
falls.
Yeah, no, I think you're exactly right. And, you know, it's you sort of mentioned in your question about sort of what does that mean for the United States? And I think the debates going on right now are surprisingly relevant to my earlier work in the sense that I think, you know, right now for the United States, we're having a lot of debates about can we form a common American identity again, right? That in fact, you know, with racial tensions and the question of the role of the white working class versus racism versus gender issues versus ethnicity and issues, and the Democratic Party is really trying to sort through this, you know, how do we construct a narrative that can fit all of those things in but still also have some common kind of narrative. And in a way, funny enough, I think that actually we're struggling with similar things. Obviously, it's a different situation. But I think it kind of brings into play the same kind of notion of the precariousness of trying to develop a sort of sense of universal and common set of identities, but at the same time respecting, right, the kind of individual identities.
Yeah,
it's very hard.
And it seems just like in the past few years that we've seen divides sharpen, just around the world. Like, we've seen the very divisive elections we've had in the U.S. We saw the Brexit. We saw the elections in France. It just seems like all at once. Yeah. Like, you think what do you think is sparking this right now, and how do we get through it?
Yeah. No, that's a great question. I mean, I actually think that a lot of what's sparking it can be traced back to economic factors. But I would argue that we should understand those economic factors situated within particular cultural contexts. So let me explain. Because, you know, there is sort of a fight right now between people who say, for example, the election of Trump is simply a function of racism, that, you know, Obama won the election and that caused a backlash against him. But of course, Obama won an election and the timing is exactly congruent with the financial crisis, right? And a real kind of dropping out of the American economy. And I would argue that actually it's perhaps no surprise when you look at the trends of the post-industrial economy in the United States, it's so transformed in the last 30 years in terms of the nature of work for people, you know, that's moved away from well-paying jobs for sort of high school graduates in a kind of union setting with benefits, with healthcare, that now work has become so much more precarious for such a large percentage of Americans that maybe we shouldn't be surprised, right, that there is a sort of populist backlash. And if you look at the income inequality stuff, right, it's crazy how much the growth of the last 30 years has gone to the top 1 to 5%. Whereas previous to that, you know, in the early post-war era, it was really spread around, right? So I think that there's a real economic story, but my new work actually is looking at how the economic story maps onto interesting geographies. So this is where I go back maybe to my undergraduate degree, hooray. It turns out that Hillary Clinton won, her voters constituted 2/3 of the U.S. GDP. And Trump's voters constituted 1/3 of the U.S. GDP. But because of the way the electoral system works, of course, you know, she won sort of not very many counties, but they were very populous and they're the very economically vibrant ones. And he won many, many counties, but they're basically very depopulated and are not well off, right? So there's this real economic cleavage that I think sort of plays out in terms of almost like these little bubbles that we live in, right? You know, we live in this sort of urban bubble where DC has really low unemployment and there's lots of jobs and it's lots of opportunity and education and public goods being provided because there's a big tax base. And then if you go to northern Louisiana, right, it's obviously a very different kind of cultural setting. Right. So my story and the plea that I make to my colleagues is that we shouldn't divide sort of the economic and the social identity stuff. We should try to think about how they interact and how they really create kind of different worlds that you live in. And so it goes back to the everyday stuff right. that I did in my other book, but kind of moves it into a different arena. So this is a project that I'm sort of getting underway. I've written a couple of papers, but I still have a lot of work to do on it.
So, like, how do we respond? Like, what do we do next?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think, unfortunately, you know, the folks on the left and the Democratic Party who traditionally should be worried about the kind of working class folks really moved away from paying attention to their needs. And I think that the Democratic Party and the Republican Party, hopefully as well, will really pay much more attention to dealing with the deindustrialization of the United States and dealing with the fact that these folks, you know, don't have good jobs, don't have good education, you know, dealing with the opiate crisis and so on. So it's a big, I mean, that's a really hard agenda, right, to try yeah. to, it would require a lot of effort. You know, I think countries like Germany and Denmark and other countries in Europe offer great sort of templates because they do things like offer high school kids these apprenticeship programs where they can really learn how to do really tangible, sometimes very high-tech kind of jobs, like, you know, using mechanical factory jobs, but that require lots of skill. So we need to train people for those types of jobs, I think. That would be one example. Do you have any answers?
I wish I had an answer. If I did, then I don't know, maybe. Yeah. Maybe the country looks like a different place now. Because, I mean, cause it's like a lot of like our traditional like industries, like coal isn't, like coal's gone, and it's there's not nothing you can do about that. Right. Like you run out of the resource, and then you see the environmental movement. Right. It's like I was just recently talking to someone working on like zoning in West Virginia, and how it's just completely transformed because like the entire nature of the work is changing. So you need like new training and education.
Right. Exactly, that's right.
A long process.
That's right, and you know I think businesses don't really like competition. They prefer to kind of just do what they've always been doing. But the problem is, it's really the green energy where all the jobs are going to be, and that's what's going to really allow us to compete internationally and so on. So we need to kind of, you know, promote, and I would say for you guys, you know, be thinking creatively about ways that you can kind of jump on these new technologies and industries and kind of work in those areas and try to kind of promote that rather than cling to the past, right?
Right. Because, change is happening.
Yeah,
like,
exactly. Right.
Just the only thing you can rely on, yeah.
Right. And to be honest, I think, you know, that's the difference. It was interesting looking at the Brexit vote, right? I'm sure you guys know, it totally tracks age, right? So, you know, like, I can't remember the numbers, but it's like, you know, 75% of the folks your age voted to stay, right? And it's the opposite, you know, for sort of 55 and above or whatever, those guys voted remain, I mean, to leave the EU. And I think it's because your generation understands that change is just the nature of the game and is not as sort of freaked out about it as perhaps some of the older folks who really don't have the ability to adjust, right? So
what do you think is going to happen? And of course, no one can see the future, but like in the UK, as our generation that was in favor of the European Union, gets in these positions of power, is it going to go back? Or?
Yeah, well, it's fascinating. When the vote first happened, I thought, well, that's it. I mean, they've done this referendum. Even though it's not binding, politically, they've sort of put themselves in this box, right? And you know, it was like craven opportunism on the part of the conservatives, people like Boris Johnson, who I like to call Bojo, by the way, Boris Johnson, and David Cameron, who thought it was never going to go through, right? But they were just interested in their own kind of internal politics and not thinking about the voters at all, I think, right? And then this outcome happens, and clearly it's, you know, worst off for the young folks who voted against it. But what's so fascinating is I feel like now it is not clear what exactly is going to happen. I used to think, okay, they have to get out because they had the vote. They have to follow that as the legitimacy of the expressed will of the voters. But then, you know, they had this second vote because Theresa May called a vote on her leadership. And she did so poorly, and Corbyn did so well, right? The Labour Party, who supposedly was to stay in the EU, that I think it's all up in the air now. And the UK government itself, the Conservatives, seem to have no plan, none, which is insane, right? Mm-hmm. After even, you know, more than a year, et cetera, et cetera. So there are certainly smart people who I respect who argue that they may not leave entirely. It may be really much more of a sort of fake Brexit. So hopefully, you know, there will be opportunities perhaps for younger folks going forward. But it's still incredibly up in the air. It's amazing, actually.
So going back to the U.S., it sounds like you're saying that if we fix like these economic problems, then the racial tension might alleviate a little bit. Of course, it's not going to be fixed, but at the same time, we have this president who has this racial rhetoric.
Of course,
that's not going to help anything. So
yeah, no, I mean it's a sort of complex layering of things, and I would argue that racism has always been a very profitable thing for people to use, right, to stir up, their own political kind of interests. And, you know, I think my dream would be, you know, for us to figure out a way to kind of unite workers of all colors to kind of see, well, who's the real enemy, right? It might be corporations that, you know, gut worker rights and no longer provide health insurance and treat their workers terribly and so on and so forth. And so, you know, that's my sort of idealistic dream, but I also know, you know, we're talking about so centuries of American history, right, that you can't just wave away, right? So I think it's going to require work on all, like, on all aspects of this. And human beings, unfortunately, do, you know, have this us versus them mentality always, and race is a very visible marker of difference, right? So I think it's something we always have to all be working on very consciously. And, you know, I've been really proud of Georgetown's reactions to the slavery issue that has involved our campus. I thought we've done a good job of trying to kind of overtly face them, but I also know there's, you know, lots of hate crimes that continue to go on around here, so.
We had, like, what, like the fourth swastika up here.
I can't believe it. I can't believe it.
It's only the fourth week of school, too.
I know. Well, clearly people are being emboldened, right? And yeah. We have to push back on that very, very strongly, you know, overtly, always, right? Is that something you feel like you guys are able to do with each other as students, that you're able to be open about tolerance and not putting up with this sort of intimidation?
I think Georgetown does do a good job of, like, initiating a dialogue. You know, there's always opportunities for a dialogue on diversity. We always see the chalk in Red Square, but clearly that's only worked to an extent because it hasn't stopped these hate crimes from happening.
Right.
Yeah. So.
And, like, we don't know who is committing these crimes, so it feels to me, like, in my community, which is very liberal, that we're just talking to each other.
Yeah, right.
And we all have the same idea, so it's not moving the discussion forward.
Absolutely, right. Well, part of the sort of story of that I'm kind of telling in my new work is about these kind of cultural class bubbles that we so much live in. I mean, I completely live in a total class bubble, sort of, you know, highly educated. And it's not simply about money. It's really about education. It is about this stuff we were talking about earlier, this sort of cosmopolitan sense of sort of your fluid identities and things like that. You know, I don't see any easy answers for that because the barriers are pretty great between, you know, these different communities, right?
Yeah.
And I do wish that, you know, our institutions of higher education could do a better job of bringing, I think it's great that Georgetown, again, does this kind of first generation stuff where they make sure to look out for talented students whose families are not, you know, PhD holding mothers, right, and all that kind of stuff, and bring them to campus. But boy, it's some big divides. Definitely.
Like I'll talk to friends I have from high school who are now at, like, small rural colleges in the South, and, like, the experience that they've had at their school and how people react to everything that's going on around the world is polar ends.
Right, right. Well, good for you for talking to them. I'm glad you guys are still talking. That's actually really good. Yeah.
Yeah, it puts things in a lot of perspective. It makes, I know it makes me realize, like, how much of a bubble I've been in at times.
Right. Definitely. Definitely.
Like, one of my friends here at Georgetown is from Atlanta, and I was just really surprised the first time she used the word Yankee, because, like, I don't hear that outside of, like, the context of baseball, you know? And I didn't realize that was still, like,
that's a thing.
Term.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. People use.
Right. Although I will also say, you know, people in New England will make fun of people with Southern accents. Right? I mean, there's, like, an interesting, and this goes back to sort of, you know, the United States, so interesting. If you look back at American history, we had very distinct kind of regional and state-based identities, right? I mean, they were nothing like the sort of 1,000 years of, you know, whatever, French. I mean, it wasn't the French state, but you talked about the different distinct, you know, kind of culture and histories in France. Ours are very short because we got rid of all the Indians, right? Genocide, that took care of that. But that being said, there was a very strong kind of sense of local identities and state identities, and it really took a very long time. And again, that's part of the kind of post-Civil War Reconstruction kind of project to sort of tell a story where we're all back together again. And I feel like maybe that story is unraveling a little now.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, I feel like it's, like, really easy in the age of globalism to just, like, assume people are going to be connected to the same kinds of news or the same kinds of ideas, but it's not necessarily
It's almost
the
opposite. Yeah. No, that's right. I mean, I think, you know, the question you asked earlier about sort of why now, you know, and I talked about economic issues, but certainly I think you could also probably tell a story about sort of increasing integration favors some people, globalization favors some people and threatens others, economically, but also culturally, right? People who feel just really sort of insecure and out of place, right, in dealing with, I don't know, there was this op-ed that a lot of my colleagues, it drove them nuts, by David Brooks. I don't know if you guys saw this in the New York Times, where he talked about going to a sandwich store with a friend who was a sort of lower class person, and all of the stuff that the sandwiches were made of were like sopressa and prosciutto, and the friend, of course, had no idea, literally no idea what these things were, right? And it dawned on David Brooks that, oh my gosh, actually, yeah, this can be very...
Intimidating,
exactly. Intimidating. And when people are intimidating, they pull back in their shells, right? And you develop these kind of cultural divides, right?
Well, then you think of, we talk about, like, the online community and whatnot. Like, if you're going online, you're not looking for different ideas. You're right. Following people that you agree with, looking for people similar to you.
Right.
So you're getting more and more.
Right. Yeah, that's right. So the internet may just sort of make this worse. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Plus, there's no fact-checking on the internet.
Right.
I actually have an interesting thing that's going on right now in my Facebook feed, which is I have friends who are Spanish, who are on different sides of this Catalan stuff that's going on. I don't know if you've heard about that at all. And that's been fascinating because I have Catalan friends who view the Spanish government as, you know, the Spanish government says it's illegal, the referendum they want to have. They want to have a binding referendum on leaving October 1. So again, you know, bye-bye Spain, right? We're going to secede. And then the Catalans think the Spanish are being authoritarian, and it's like Franco regime all over again. My Spanish friends, who are not Catalan, are saying, you know, they're trying to act outside of the law and outside of the Constitution, and it's completely nuts. You know, there's no, you know, they want self-determination, but they're not acting within the legal procedures, and they don't necessarily have, you know, I mean, they're very well off. There's no, like, political repression, really, right? But on the other hand, I'm really seeing these two streams where people look at the same thing with completely different assumptions about what's happening. It's been fascinating. I don't know what's going to happen with that one. That's another big one.
Yeah. See, I feel like with, like, a lot of what's going on, at least in my personal opinion and experience, like, the importance of, like, facilitating a dialogue and having, like, the two kind of perspectives, like, try to develop some understanding, but the process of initiating that kind of dialogue.
Yeah, and particularly at this point in time, again, you know, sort of when you have the bigger kind of political structures, and I would argue the political elites have done just a terrible job, you know, in the British case, certainly nobody was making the sort of EU case in any kind of measured way, one way or the other. In the US case, that's certainly, you know, been true. I think France is interesting because Emmanuel Macron, the French president, you know, ran against Marie Le Pen, who is the sort of, you know, populist, racist, you know, whatever. And he won. And he won by actually his supporters at his rallies would have EU flags and French flags. So the symbols and practices, McNamara would say, were actually, you know, an interesting example of trying to sort of overtly, you know, sort of be politically aware of the notion that we are European, but we're also French, and we're going to explicitly kind of make that part of our partisan contestation, right? Whereas in the past, people had sort of avoided talking about the EU, like everybody was like, yeah, that's good, and they didn't really address the backlash against it. I think Macron is an interesting example of hopefully what you said, you know, sort of starting to kind of bring together people and discuss in overt ways the various problems. But he is now trying to do things like roll back some of the labor laws in France. So he's getting the workers and the unions very mad at him. So we'll see how he manages that.
Wow. Yeah. See, I feel, and like I'm not an expert on like the elections in France or any of that. But I think especially if you're looking at the election in the U.S., so much of it seems more reactive than proactive. Yeah, so it's like a lot of like, this shouldn't be happening, this shouldn't be happening, we can't do this, don't do this, but less of what do we do?
Absolutely. I would agree. And I'm looking forward to your generation coming in and actually doing a positive kind of leadership forward and figuring all this stuff out. And, I mean, I'm joking, but I'm not joking, actually. So,
and best of luck, guys.
That's right. But I do think we are in this, you know, period of incredible transformation and everything's sort of being rewritten. And it's going to mean that your careers are going to kind of unfold at a time when we're just going to see so much change going forward.
So how do you see the relationship between the U.S. and Europe kind of develop from now on?
Well, that's a great question. So, I mean, you know, I think the Europeans really just don't know what to do with Donald Trump. He sort of goes against, you know, most of the common shared ideas that they have. And even, you know, the more conservative folks like Theresa May still find him, you know, very confusing to deal with. The U.S. and Europe, you know, have the strongest sort of set of economic and investment ties in terms of just foreign direct investment, you know, actually investing mm-hmm. in factories and things like that in each other's countries. And so there are a lot of very interested, wealthy people who will sort of make sure that we continue to have a positive relationship. And I think that's holding for now, actually. And I think the diplomats at levels sort of below the executive level have really good relationships. And so they continue to try to just interact with each other and just sort of ignore the stuff at the top. That's what I'm seeing right now. Yeah.
Talking about government, you spent a couple years in the Congress working as a legislative assistant for one of the representatives. How did that influence your interests, your goals, your career?
Well, I'm glad you brought that up because I think that is one really important thing for you guys to kind of be aware of. You know, I did this geography degree and then I worked in regional planning in New York City, and that kind of led to, I was always interested in Congress and Capitol Hill and politics and arguing and all that good stuff. And so off I went and I got an unpaid internship on the Hill working for my member of Congress, who was this guy, Stuart McKinney, who was actually a Republican, because back in the day, you know, New England Republicans were these really nice, moderate, sensible, kind of, you know, down to earth folks. And he was really, really great to work for, and I absolutely loved it. And I worked for him for three, 4 years or so. But I finally got to the point where I was like, you know, I really want to go back to graduate school. So then I went to Columbia and I did an international affairs degree because I thought, I want to join the Foreign Service. That sounds really fun. You know, that would be great. Took the Foreign Service exam, got an appointment. But while I was there, I was like, I love these classes that are like PhD classes. I'll apply for a PhD, and my professors were very supportive. So I got an offer to do a PhD at Columbia or to go into the Foreign Service. So then I had to decide. Yeah, and I decided to do the PhD because I absolutely adored it. But I also thought, at the time I was actually dating this guy who I thought, maybe I want to marry him, and how is he going to move every 2-3 years to follow me? Maybe it'd be easier if I was an academic, which of course is ludicrous because the academic job market is terrible. It's amazing I could ever get a job. But in that moment, I actually just sort of, number one, I didn't know I was going to be a Georgetown professor. If, you know, at your age, somebody had said that to me, I just would have laughed at them. I'm like, what are you talking about? So it's okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's okay if you don't know what you're going to be 10 years from now. In fact, it's really good to explore and to try different things, right? And the other thing was I was also, you know, there were a lot of things that I enjoyed and was passionate about. And I did kind of think about, all right, I want to balance that. I want to actually try to have a life, right? And being a professor is really hard. I'm going to be honest with you, particularly to get tenure and all that kind of stuff. But it does allow you to sort of set your own hours. So I was able to have 2 kids while I was at Princeton as an untenured faculty member. And it's super hard, but I felt like I was able to kind of juggle things and do what I loved. And so you kind of have to be, you have to be very stubborn and realize what do you really love and then just go for it. You know what I mean? And just make it work somehow. Mm-hmm. And if you're good and if you're really focused, people will seek you out, and you can actually have a very full life, which I feel like I have and have had. So that's my inspirational talk for the day.
Why did you decide to come to Georgetown?
So I was at Princeton, and when you're in the Ivy League, generally speaking, it's very hard to get tenure in your first job. You come as an assistant professor, and you, generally speaking, none of my friends got tenure. So I thought, I should look for another job someplace else and go someplace and get tenure. So I was on the job market, and I had friends at Georgetown who encouraged me to apply for a job. And I did, and I got the job, and they were very nice, and they brought me in with tenure, so then I just, then I was done with that. And, you know, let's face it, D.C., I mean, I was a D.C. native, right, even though I came and went from D.C., I consider myself a D.C. native, and it's such a great city, it just keeps getting better and better.
It's the most beautiful city in the world, if you ask me.
And there's so much going on here. And, of course, if you're interested in politics, it's a pretty gosh darn place, good place to be. But I'll tell you guys another story, which is I taught a lecture class at Princeton, International Political Economy. And I came down and started teaching it here, and I had to upgrade my notes because you guys were so much better than the Princeton students in the political science area. So I was like, damn it, I have to make my notes harder, and like, I can't ask these rhetorical questions and have them say stupid things, and then I come in with the really smart thing, because usually the SFS in particular, SFS and government students would be like, oh, but, you know, globalization, the world isn't flat, Tom Friedman is completely wrong. I'd be like, yeah, you're right, actually. He is complete, you know. So I feel like you guys are really, you know, well-trained and deeply trained and really, you know, I've been just incredibly happy here. Very, very happy.
You also, I read that you also, like, advise policymakers. Mm-hmm. Do you find it, is it easier to, like, influence American policymakers or European?
That's a great question, yeah.
The U.S. has a long strain of anti-intellectualism, and I feel like, or maybe I'm just more aware of it now, but I feel like it's risen the past couple of years.
Right. So it's interesting. The Europeans have engaged me with my work, and particularly actually the European Central Bank folks and various national governments. I've talked to them about kind of European stuff. But I actually do have an ongoing relationship with something called the National Intelligence Council, which actually is a very kind of high-level, very kind of intellectually oriented group that is spans the CIA, Department of Defense, State Department, and basically tries to develop different kinds of scenarios and sort of planning documents to kind of clue policymakers into kind of big trends in the world. And it's organized by a colleague of mine called John Eikenberry, who's at Princeton. And he brings together like 10 to 20, depending on the day, academics. And we sit around and talk about what's happening in the world. And the policymakers kind of listen and ask us questions. So there's an explicit engagement with academics, which is nice. The other thing that I think is really cool is more and more my colleagues are doing things like writing for Foreign Affairs or Foreign Policy or this thing called the Monkey Cage, which is on the Washington Post website, where political scientists basically talk about their research in kind of real-world engaged ways that anyone can understand. So I think there's been a really nice kind of shift to academics trying to engage in the public sphere. And of course, again, Georgetown is, you know, a great place for that. Like, my colleagues really enjoy that a lot. I think there's room for it.
Yeah.
I feel like we have very much like a culture of engagement here and a culture of like an like a very global mindset.
Definitely. Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. Yeah. I agree.
Have you ever met Angela Merkel or Theresa May? Or?
I have not, actually. I have not. No, the only kind of celebrity policymaker I know is Secretary Albright, because I was director of Mortara Center for 6 years, and she's Mortara professor, so she has an office in her building and runs classes, and she and I have done a bunch of events together. So she's, she's an amazing woman, really inspirational, really terrific.
Do you think identity matters for policymakers when they're writing laws?
I think identity is always everywhere with us, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, we can't kind of escape it, and I've always rejected the notion that somehow, you know, voters or citizens or policymakers can only be understood as sort of these almost like economic, rational kind of actors who are not actually social creatures. They're clearly, we're all social, we're human beings, right? Yeah. So all those things are always at work, right? That's how I see the world.
But at the same time, you don't want to be like essentialist. Like,
exactly.
For me, like when Hillary Clinton basically said you should vote for me because I'm a woman, I was like really turned off, even though obviously I'm a feminist, because I feel like I should vote for her because of her policies and what she thinks.
But then on the other hand, you have Ivanka Trump saying, oh, clearly I'm a woman, so feminism is on this side too. There's
this is one of the most important points, and my colleagues who don't really study this stuff sometimes get that wrong, where they think culture is something you're born with, it's in your DNA. I'm very much, as you know, having read my work, you know, it's socially constructed, right? And we mm-hmm. reconstruct it every moment of the day, right? And they're very stable kind of categories and understandings we have about what it is to be feminine, what it is to be masculine, but that doesn't mean that we can't reinterpret those things and change them over time. And, you know, it's interesting. I'm at a point in my career where, you know, I'm very, very senior now, and it has allowed me to sort of step back and sort of look back and sort of realize, you know, I have performed masculinity. That's one of the reasons that I've been successful, is I feel like I've been able to sort of embrace certain traditional masculine traits of maybe being argumentative and, you know, self-confident and so on. But at the same time, I always have to kind of realize, too, that as a woman, you have to a little bit take the edge off, right? You know, there's all this data that shows that women who are more aggressive and so on get sort of slapped down, right? So there's a real balancing act, I think, that women have to follow. But I suppose on the other side, you know, men who really love, you know, doing housework and taking care of their kids may suffer a lot of sort of social disdain, right, for not being traditionally masculine. So I think, you know, it can go both ways.
But can that change, though? Like, I hate to think that my confidence is making me, like, less of a woman or anything. Just
right, exactly.
For being confidence.
Right. Yeah, and I've really enjoyed, actually, I have a bunch of female friends who are all sort of now getting to the point where they're pretty senior. And so I feel like we're sort of constructing our own kind of way of being successful in the field, which, you know, can be very confident, but also doesn't hide from the fact that, you know, we have kids and we care about those kids and they're a huge priority to us as well. And that doesn't detract from us as professionals. So I think you can, hopefully. Mm-hmm. Hopefully. Again, another task for your generation, right?
Yeah.
Remaking all this stuff.
I think we have to wrap up soon. So I have two last questions for you. What is your advice for women going into politics or scholarship? Mm-hmm. And also, what do you love the most about your work?
Oh, great. Okay. So my advice, and I kind of hinted at it a little bit, is, you know, find something you really love, because that's what you'll be successful at. Don't kind of fall into, everyone is interviewing for McKinsey, so I guess I should go do that. That's fine. If you're actually completely in love with the notion of being a management consultant, go do that. But otherwise, make sure to sort of find your own path. Because the fact that you're at Georgetown means that you're incredibly capable and very bright and, you know, have a lot of kind of gifts going forward. So find something that you really love. But also realize, I would say, the first sort of 5 to 8 to 10 years of your career, you're going to have to work really hard, right, to establish yourself as somebody who's really, really good. And then if you do want to have a family and kids, you know, having sort of made those great strides, then you can start kind of calling your own shots, right? And sort of making sure that you really have the life that you want to lead. So you have to be quite stubborn. But I have a feeling you guys would be okay with that, right?
I'll take an excuse to be stubborn.
What?
I'll take an excuse to be stubborn.
There you go. In terms of what do I love the most about my job, I love learning. I just adore kind of the idea, and it's such a luxury in, you know, sort of the modern world and everything in the, you know, capitalist system. The fact that, like, this new work that I'm doing, you know, I'm reading all the stuff that I've never read before, and I'm reading really smart people, and I'm kind of putting together my own ideas about things. And I feel like I just keep growing every time I get the opportunity to learn something. So it's really fun.
Okay. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
Thank
it's
you
a
so
pleasure.
Much.
It's great.
Yeah, it's great having you here. I really appreciate it.
Sure.
Follow us on Twitter at Georgetown Voice and at Halftime GU. Emily's Twitter is MLE Jaster and mine is KAEI_LI. You can also find more podcasts on GeorgetownVoice.com or subscribe to the Voice Podcast Network on iTunes. Thank you.